You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a new Wisconsin podcast has a goal of supporting incarcerated people and their families. We'll talk with the host about his inspiration for the show and the stories he's shared so far. Now, when Chris Kimbrough left his home in Arkansas to come to Wisconsin, he brought with him a passion for cutting hair and building community through the barbershop business. He's the owner of Stars Barber and Beauty of Green Bay, which got a visit from Governor Evers last month during a stop in the city. Earlier this year, he opened a new location in UW-Green Bay's Student Union. He's also been cutting hair on the St. Norbert University campus. Part of his mission with the new shop is to make students of color more comfortable on their college campus and get them the haircuts they might otherwise wait for until they drive or fly home. We talked to Chris Kimbrough ahead of the launch of his campus location. Here's a listen. Why did you want to start making sure your haircuts were available on those two campuses?
You know, we just wanted to make sure that, you know, people of color felt at home while they were here. You know, we had a lot of people, a lot of students that were coming in town and, you know, already visited my other locations that I have. And they were just, you know, voicing some concerns about, you know, coming in town to Green Bay area where they just felt like, you know, it didn't feel like home, or they was like, oh, I miss home and I miss, you know, being able to get haircuts like I want all the time and all that. So, you know, we kind of partnered with the university to try to make things better for them and just kind of make them feel at home more, so we have to worry about them transferring to other communities and things of that nature. Really just also back in Wisconsin, you know, the snowstorms and things like that happen. It's just safer for them to be on campus than to be traveling all around the community trying to get haircuts. And if I can make that an easier way for them or a better life while they're here in town, I that's what I want to do.
Now, let's start with the haircuts in particular. You had guys on campus saying, I think they were going to wait till, you know, winter break or summer break or whatever to get a haircut because they didn't have local barbers that could meet their needs.
Right. They will go to, they will, you know, a lot of students, they'll wait till you get back home or, you know, and on some type of break, summer break, winter break or whatever to get haircuts. And I'm like, no, you know, we can try to make things better because I do have a couple other locations as well, and they stay booked up all the time. So, you know, we just saw opportunity to be able to come together and make things better for them. And, you know, we jumped on the opportunity.
When you're a barber, you get a chance to talk to your clients. What kind of concerns, what kind of worries do they talk about in their college careers?
You know, a lot of guys just, again, they talk about being here, a new area. You know, change is always difficult at times. And so, you know, some of the guys that come from different towns, even Illinois, Missouri, or wherever, you know, it's just, and coming here to Wisconsin where it's always cold and you know, it's always snowy, seem like, things of that nature, just they kind of get a little depressed sometimes. And so being a barber and knowing the history of barbering, we were usually your town's big brothers, your town psychologists, like we were the counselors, because, you know, like I know, everybody knows, you know, what goes on in the barbershop. Everybody talks to the barber. We know everything that goes on in the community. So, you know, being able to have that outlet for them to come talk to and kind of help them, encourage them on a day-to-day basis, somebody they can actually have there as a big brother or even a big sister, that means a lot to them.
Is there a concern that they feel like they really stand out? I was just looking at the numbers for both campuses, mostly white, fairly few black people by percentage. Is it just nice for them to have a community where they don't stand out for the length of a haircut?
Exactly. It's very important for them. You know, it's very important for them to feel welcome. And one thing about the business that I brought here is where I come from, you see a lot of Caucasian, they stick with Caucasian shops. A lot of the black people, they stick with a lot of the black shops. Well, I wanted to make sure I bring something together where we all could come together as one. And with Black History Month coming up, I always think about Dr. Martin Luther King, one of the things he said is, you know, for us to come together. He had a dream that we all would be together. You know, and sometimes looking out at the shop and seeing every different race and every different culture all together in one place, having a good time and talking about sports or talking about things that are going on in the world, it's a beautiful thing. It is. It's a really beautiful thing. And having the students being able to witness that is even more beautiful.
Now, you're running a business, of course, but it sounds like it's super important for you, Chris, to help build community. Why is that important to you?
Well, me personally, my mom, I come from a single parent home. My mom, may she rest in peace, she passed recently last year in January, and she was a teacher. She was she worked in the educational field. So I kind of grew up with a hospitable heart come from my mother, my upbringing. So it's just me being an ex-police officer as well. I work with communities, and I see the things in the community that community needs. And me being here and coming from law enforcement, I still had that community heart in me, you know. And so I just came here, and I saw the things that need to be done, and I'm a real go-getter. I'm real proactive. I don't like to be a reactive person. I like to prevent things if we can keep it from happening. When the George Floyd thing went down a couple years ago, I had an event in front of my shop. Let's talk. Let's come together. Let's talk. Let's try to prevent what happened in other communities from happening here. And that's what we did. And that's what I'm all about.
Now, Chris, you've been working on St. Norbert's campus. You're headed to UW-Green Bay now. What are your hopes? What do you hope comes out of all this effort?
You know, just togetherness, unity. I just love it. I just love being that person that they can come to when they have questions or even concerns in the area. I just love doing it. And that's what matters to me, is that the kids feel at home. They feel more safe, more comfortable being here away from home. And a parent from St. Norbert, example, his mom is from Alaska, I believe, and he got a haircut. And his mother hit me up on social media and, you know, was just expressing how much she appreciated us being there for him, how much she appreciated him getting his haircut, because he wasn't getting his haircut, you know, on a normal basis like he should have or even was accustomed to where he was from. And she just, you know, she appreciated it. And to me, that done my heart well. If I know I can be a help for someone, that's what I try to do.
Chris, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That was Chris Kimbrough, owner of Stars Barber and Beauty of Green Bay. We talked to him earlier this year about opening up an on-campus haircut spot at UW-Green Bay, as well as a project at St. Norbert College to help students of color in the Green Bay area feel more at home. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to a question about language.
Wisconsin recently received a listener question from Catherine Bolt. She wonders, what is the third most commonly spoken language in Wisconsin after English and Spanish? The answer? Hmong. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy looks into why.
That was Macy Herr, the executive director of Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce, introducing herself in Hmong.
So I'm Hmong American. I grew up, for the most part, in the Wausau area, attended high school there.
Herr calls herself a 1.5 generation Hmong American, meaning she moved to the United States with her parents when she was young. Many Hmong Americans who came to the United States from Southeast Asia were from isolated mountain villages in Laos, Vietnam, and Thailand. During the Vietnam War, the U.S. recruited many Hmong people to help fight the North Vietnamese. When the U.S. withdrew from Vietnam in 1975, thousands of Hmong fled to refugee camps in Thailand and later resettled in the U.S.
There were many families that were sponsored by groups and organizations, many of them faith-based or churches specifically, in the Wisconsin area. We ended up moving to Wisconsin to be with the rest of our, or should I say, a good portion of our family in Wisconsin.
Today, about 50,000 Hmong people call Wisconsin home, making it the third largest state population in the country behind California and Minnesota. While Hmong is the third most commonly spoken language in Wisconsin behind English and Spanish, less than 1% of the population speaks it. UNESCO predicts the Hmong language will likely die out by the end of this century. Song Shong, executive director of Gia Shia in La Crosse, said there are several reasons for that. She spoke with me about it from home as her child played in another room.
Hmong is one of the hardest languages to learn because it's a tonal language. You know, a lot of Westerners have a hard time speaking Mandarin because it's four tones. And with Hmong, you double those, so it's eight tones.
The meaning of a word changes based on the tone used.
So, for example, if I was to say the word red in Hmong is lia. So if I say the word in different tones, it will go something like lia, 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 lia.
The different tones change the word from red to rice paddy, disgusting, and rice harvesting tool. The other four tones don't have meaning. And then Sean points to the difference between generations.
It's also a dying language. Because it's not being passed down at all. It's not being used. The folks that use it are our elders who don't speak any other language other than Hmong.
English is everywhere, Herr says, While she can speak Hmong conversationally, teaching it to her 6-year-old son is a challenge when he's surrounded by English in school, with his friends, and on television.
I fear for myself, my own son, you know, for, as someone who values the language and the culture, it's hard to pass those things down to your child in a society where you still want them to thrive and understand the culture in which they live in.
But those hurdles don't keep her and Shang from being optimistic. They both organize annual Hmong language and culture camps for kids. And her says she sees signs of younger Hmong people looking to reclaim their heritage.
The Hmong are an indigenous group of people. You know, we don't have a home country to go back to. Whatever we can keep alive, the people, the language is so, so important.
Shang says to really keep the language alive, it will take those in the Hmong community coming together and advocating for the language to be implemented in grade schools and universities.
But most importantly, I think it takes non-Hmong folks to also support those causes. It comes from the Hmong community wanting it, and then the dominant culture, non-Hmong folks also advocating for those things as well.
WPR digital producer Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on the Hmong language, the third most commonly spoken language in Wisconsin. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, the host of a new podcast tells us about his mission to get the word out about resources for incarcerated people and their families here in Wisconsin. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. A new podcast shares the stories of currently and formerly incarcerated people in Wisconsin, and it spreads the word about resources available to them and their families. The Out of the Box podcast has been putting out bi-weekly episodes since April, featuring talks with peer support specialists, parole officers, and others. Dee Starr is the host of the Out of the Box podcast, which you can listen to on many platforms. You can find a link at WPR.org/Central Time. I talked to him earlier today. Well, what got you interested in doing this podcast focused on the experience of people in the incarceration system and the resources that are out there for them?
Well, I've been affected for my brother. My brother is currently incarcerated right now. So I'm one of those people that actually was going back and forth to the prisons, visiting my brother, you know, and I have uncles that's and you know, family members that's been in prison. So it's like, you know, I kind of grew up around it. So it's like, man, how can I help these people, you know, other people just like me that's going through the same things, you know,
can you
give them a platform so they can, you know, go forward in life.
Can you talk about the range of guests that people will hear when they start listening to your podcast?
Yeah. So we talk to everybody. So basically we talk to incarcerated, formerly incarcerated people. We talk to aldermen. We'll talk to board members. We talk to community leaders. We talk to music producers. We talk to just everybody, you know.
And one person you talked to was Stacy Clay. He served about 28 years in prison here in Wisconsin. Now he's a peer support specialist who helps people using anesis therapy. Here's a clip sharing some good news he got on the day you talked with him.
Today I just got the news because being a certified peer specialist, what I found out is that even though I was out of prison, I did my time and I served my time and I did all these other things and had accolades, that I was trying to work with a certain segment of clients, group of clients, and I had to go through the in front of a board of rehabilitation to get permission to give services to these clients. And so today I just got approved and got okay to give services.
And that made me smile. That's serious, man. Yeah. That's just.
Absolutely.
Man, to just give, I know it's going to give hope to so many people.
Can you tell us some more about Stacy's story and the kind of work he's doing now?
So Stacy is a great guy. He actually went to prison for about 28 years for a murder. He served his time. He's come home, completely changed his life. Like you say, he's a peer support specialist now. He heads up a mentor group at Mount Zion Baptist Church here in Madison, Wisconsin. And he does a lot of great work with the youth and with the community.
Now, you've talked to a lot of different people, including, you know, knowing your own family members. What are a couple of the biggest challenges people face when they're making that transition from being in prison to being back out again?
Well, one of the biggest things that I hear is just navigating the probation and parole process. That's like one of the biggest things. And you can get violated for, you know, pretty much a victimless crime, for like a rule violation, and go back to prison. Or you can go back to prison just off strictly allegation. So that's when somebody just calls in and says, hey, this person did something. So without no evidence, without any trial, without being convicted of anything, you can be sent back to prison.
What kind of help can there be? What kind of help is there for people who want to make sure they don't violate the rules, who want to make sure they don't end up back in the system?
Well, there is groups like Expo. Expo is Ex-Prisoners Organized. So they actually have programs that you can get into, and they will help you navigate the probation and parole office. I mean, you know, like, so basically they have like peer support specialists for people that's on probation and parole.
We're talking to D Star, host of the Out of D Box podcast, focused on supporting currently and formerly incarcerated people and their families. And D, can you talk about what family members of people who are incarcerated need to know? What kind of help might be out there for them?
There, like I said before, there is a program called Expo. Mm-hmm. And they should really get in contact with Expo, because they do a lot of work for the incarcerated, formerly incarcerated, and their families. So they have programs that they can help people get back and forth to go see them, keep in contact with them. They like pay your rent. They do a lot of different things. So Expo, I would send people to Expo.
Now, you and your podcast, you're kind of doing the job I do here. You're talking to people, getting them to open up. What does it take sometimes to get people to be willing to share what are, you know, in some cases, pretty difficult stories?
A good interviewer. pretty much, you have to make the people feel comfortable and know that, you know, connect with them like, hey, I've been through the same things that you've gone through. And it's okay to share, and it's okay not to share sometimes, you know. And we go through the editing process, and sometimes we take a lot of things out. But, you know, I would say that just making the people feel comfortable.
You, as you mentioned, you've got family members currently in the system or who have been. What are some of the things you've learned along the way that you didn't know coming into this podcast process?
Oh, wow. One of the things that I've learned is when someone does a lot of time in prison, 20, 30 years, how remorseful they really are. And I think that's what people need to understand too. It's like, you know, just because someone killed someone, or just because someone did a heinous crime, you know, a long time ago, and they did their time, they come home. You need to understand that those people had a lot of time to think about it, and they are remorseful. So it's just like, try not to judge people for the actual crime that they committed, because everybody makes mistakes.
Yeah, that makes me wonder for if there's somebody out there listening who, you know, hasn't been incarcerated themselves, who doesn't have that family experience you had, what are you hoping they take away from listening to the interviews you're doing?
Understanding. So we do a lot of different interviews with a lot of different people, and from all walks of life. So you can, you know, if you don't connect with the reentry part of our podcast, we actually have another part of the podcast where we're talking about, like I just did one with Zach and Veronica from Just Bakery, and she was talking about Veronica was talking about how she went through sexual abuse with her, you know, with an uncle, and she shared that story and how she was, you know, an escort, you know, and she was, you know, and how she came up out of that and how she went through the Just Bakery program and she, you know, changed her whole life. Now she has an apartment and she's like a teacher now and she's doing great. So it's like, it's a lot of inspirational stories and things that you can get out of my podcast, not just, you know, the incarcerated and formerly incarcerated part too. And we have a lot of poetry also.
And what is next for the podcast and for your work on it?
So next for the podcast, we're going to actually start doing the video part of it. So, and just real quick, we have, we're going to be a part of this movie called Slam. It's a faith-based movie about four girls who band together, start up a volleyball team to enter a tournament and to win $10,000 to save their church. It's going to be shot here locally in Dane County. And if you guys want to be a part of that, there's $1,000 cash giveaway, right, for the winner and a trophy. You just go to volleyballslam.com and you sign up. It's a 4-on-4 women's volleyball tournament. So it's great. It's four great calls.
Dee, thanks a lot for sharing your work with us today.
No problem. Thank you.
Dee Starr is host of the new Out of the Box podcast focused on supporting currently and formerly incarcerated people and their families. We talked to him earlier today. You can find episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more. We've also got a link at wpr.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, American consumers are building up higher levels of credit card debt. We'll look at the numbers and potential risks and get some advice on managing our credit. And we'll dig into the history behind a Wisconsin legend, the creation of Dungeons & Dragons, and the rise and fall of the company behind it, all centered around their roots in Lake Geneva. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Inflation Reduction Act, just passed by Congress, includes tax credits for electric vehicles. We'll find out what it means for consumers and for the future of the auto industry. First, pedestrian deaths spiked across the U.S. during the pandemic, and numbers in Wisconsin have gone up, too. In the first half of last year, 39 pedestrians were killed in the state. The Governor's Highway Safety Administration says that's close to double the number of fatalities in the same period of 2020. Our next guest says there are ways to make streets safer. He says one place to start is how we design our streets and roads. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a dangerous street or intersection where you live? Do you feel safe walking around in your community? Do you feel safe letting your kids, say, walk around in your community? Are there solutions you would like to see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Robert Schneider is a professor and chair of UW-Milwaukee's Department of Urban Planning. He specializes in sustainable transportation, modeling, and safety analysis. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Great to be back again.
What are you seeing in pedestrian death numbers and pedestrian safety over the last couple of years?
Well, it's been an unfortunate trend, actually, not just since the pandemic, but really since the Great Recession. 2009 in the United States was the lowest pedestrian fatality numbers in recorded memory, when we had about 4,100 pedestrian deaths in that year. 2021 is projected to have more than 7,000 pedestrians killed, so more than a 50% increase over a decade. Which is very disappointing. It has been an increase that is more than the increases in fatalities for other transportation modes, such as automobiles.
A lot of times, I think the solutions to this kind of problem are, hey, drivers drive safer, pedestrians walk safer. And that's true. We all want that. But a lot of your research looks at roadways and streets, how they're designed. You, in your research, found hot spots that were very unsafe for pedestrians. Can you tell us a little bit about that work?
Yes, my colleagues and I looked at a number of locations where fatalities had occurred. We have a very good reporting system for roadway fatalities across the country. And so we looked at every roadway in the entire country and looked for places where there were six or more pedestrian fatalities over an 8-year period within 1,000 meters, or about 3 football fields long. And so there were 31 of these hotspot locations between 2001 and 2008, and then there were another 34 between 2009 and 2016. In total, there were 60 different locations, and they tended to have similar characteristics. And this is the key point, because fatalities in where they occur shift over time. You may not see a fatality occur in a particular location 1 year after another, but the same types of locations tend to have the highest risk. And so what we saw were these hot spots were places where they were multi-lane roadways, often 4 lanes or 6 lanes. It was often a state highway in a urban or suburban community. It often had relatively long distances between where pedestrians could cross the roadway with a signalized crossing. And unfortunately, we also saw an equity component to this, where 75% of these hotspots were in lower income communities, and communities of color were also overrepresented in these hotspot locations.
We're talking to Robert Schneider, professor and chair of UW-Milwaukee's Department of Urban Planning, looking at the hazards pedestrians face walking on American roadways, what makes particular roads less safe than others. You can join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with a report from your own community, your own neighborhood. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Edward joins us in Cedarburg. Edward, hello.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. The thing I was thinking about, I'm originally from Europe. I'm from England. We have crosswalks in Europe, but they're not just painted on the road like oftentimes in America. You know, the drivers have to look on the road to see the crosswalk. I mean, we have like sort of quasi traffic lights by the crosswalks, the amber, and they flash, and there's one either side. And, it's like, they're like sacred. You know, if somebody steps on a crosswalk, you stop, you know, they stop, the drivers stop. You don't go cruising through no matter where they are on the crosswalk. I just don't think we give pedestrians enough respect. You know, the pedestrians were here before the cars. You know?
Edward, thanks for the call. So Bob, a couple things there. Partly it's the culture, but also he says how much of an indication there is to drivers that there is a crosswalk. A painted on only one does tend to be pretty, I guess, hypothetical for a lot of drivers.
Yes. Well, let me start with a couple of points that are related to what he said. And it calls on us to make educational improvements. So make sure that drivers and pedestrians and bicyclists and everybody knows the rules of the roadway. So drivers should know that it is a state law when a pedestrian sets their foot in a crosswalk that they need to yield to that pedestrian, yield the right of way to them to cross the street. Enforcement is another piece of strategies to address safety. And so having enforcement of the laws so that drivers are reminded how to obey those laws and pedestrians and bicyclists as well. But he also touched on an incredibly important point, which gets to the underlying risk within the system. So if you have a crosswalk that is just painted with lines on the roadway, it may be relatively difficult for an approaching driver to see that crosswalk, especially at night when 75% of the pedestrian fatalities occur. So what can we do to engineer the roadway to be safer for those types of pedestrian crossings? So we had one idea. We use a treatment called a rapid flashing beacon at some crosswalks to really highlight that it's there. So you'll see flashing lights on both sides of the roadway, alerting the driver to a pedestrian being present. But I think we can go further than that too, because the underlying risk of any particular street or roadway also has a lot to do with its geometric design and the speed of vehicles that it is designed for. And higher speeds lead to higher impact crashes. So if you can design a street within an urban or suburban environment in particular, where you're likely to have many pedestrian crossings, if you can design that to be a slower speed, if there does happen to be a crash, then that pedestrian will have a lower level of injury. And ways to design for lower speed is not only having the flashing beacons at crosswalks, but having roadway lanes that are narrow enough to communicate that this is a slower speed environment, having curb extensions at the ends of crosswalks or at corners when drivers are turning so that they can't go through that space quite as fast. And it communicates that, hey, this is a place where you're likely to expect pedestrians and you should travel a little bit slower. And that's communicated through the design itself.
Thanks for that call, Edward. There's a core concept I keep coming across, Bob, the idea that streets are one thing. It's a place where you stop off and do stuff, and you might walk from point A to point B. Roads are a way to drive from point A to point B, but so much of our design is some of the design people call them strodes, where you try to make that high pedestrian area where cars are going, you know, they're really designed for cars. Can you talk about the concept of the strode, the combination between street and road?
Yes, and I believe it was Charles Mohan or somebody to that effect who first coined that term maybe 10 or 15 years ago. So I don't want to take credit for that, but it really recognizes that we have urban and suburban oriented areas where you have high levels of activity, but we've designed the street to act like a high capacity, high speed thoroughfare for cars. And in that sort of environment, you have the highest risk for pedestrians who are crossing the street or walking along the street. In some cases, these strodes, as we might call them, have transit service. So they've got bus stops along them where people are trying to get in on and off the bus by accessing getting across the street to their bus stop. So the idea of prioritizing throughput for the automobiles in those corridors is contradictory to the safety of the people trying to cross. One other thing about it is that some of the communities where these higher speed, multi-lane highways practically have been put through urban areas that had been developed in the past, essentially those highways cut through former business districts. And so you can think of a state highway that may go through Main Street in a small town in Wisconsin, or the state highways like 151 in Madison, East Washington Avenue, or Fond du Lac Avenue in Milwaukee. These may have had a large number of local businesses in the past, but now the highway has cut through where those businesses had been and really detracts from that commercial environment for the local neighborhood businesses.
We're talking to Robert Schneider from UW-Milwaukee's Department of Urban Planning, looking at pedestrian safety in the U.S. and ways to make our streets safer by designing them to be safer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel safe walking around the streets in your neighborhood, or do you worry about high-speed traffic coming through on these things that are more roadway than street? Do you have questions for our guest or ideas, solutions of your own? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about an uptick in pedestrian fatalities across the U.S. during the pandemic and what can be done to turn those numbers in the other direction, in part by the way we design our streets. Robert Schneider from UW-Milwaukee's Department of Urban Planning stays with us, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences with a dangerous street in your neck of the woods. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. So I heard the previous caller talking about the crosswalks with flashing lights, and I just wanted to share. So I'm calling from Appleton, and we have Appleton, the city, has installed a couple of those kinds of crosswalks downtown in recent years. And they did so in response to a couple of Lawrence students ending up getting hit by cars downtown. And then I was also listening to your guest remarking on kind of strodes and things like that. And College Avenue, which is downtown Appleton, part of it is a great example of that. It has four, you know, it's divided and has four lanes, but it also tries to, you know, stick in these pedestrian crosswalks. And Appleton has tried to become, you know, more bicycle and more pedestrian friendly over the last few years with the addition of some bike lanes and things like that. But we're still not anywhere close to somewhere like Madison or some European city.
Michael, thanks for the call. Bob, your thoughts on what Michael reports from Appleton?
Yeah, I've been along College Avenue before, and I think it is a good example of the challenge that we have. For pedestrian safety, I think we need to step back a little bit too and think of where we are as a country. It's important to know that as we've seen our pedestrian fatalities increase by more than 50% over the last decade, most other countries across the world have not seen that same change. Most have actually seen pedestrian fatalities decrease. And it goes to the fundamental ways that we think about our transportation system. And I'll get back to Michael's point here along College Avenue. Why is it that we have not prioritized the safety of pedestrian crossings? Well, for decades, really post-World War II, all the way up till, 2000 or the early 20-teens, even in some places, the main concept behind roadway engineering was to move motor vehicles as quickly and efficiently as possible from place to place. And the primary metric that engineers and planners were using was a concept called level of service. And essentially, you had to keep the traffic flowing along any roadway, and you needed to build more travel lanes and wider roadways so you could accommodate that extra traffic volume so that it wouldn't get congested. But what we've seen in the thinking in the last decade or so has changed to say, hey, there's other types of users, there's other benefits of our streets besides just moving cars quickly from place to place. There's support for local business districts, there's pedestrian safety like we're talking about today, there's neighborhood beautification, adding greenery and medians and trees and those sorts of things. Those can all be great uses of street space. And so simply using one metric that says we need cars to go as quickly as possible along the street, which is really the concept behind why College Avenue is the way it is, that needs to be revisited. And we need to take fundamental steps back in how we think about our transportation system so that it becomes safer. One way that this is being done is through the type of program called Vision Zero. Both Madison and Milwaukee have established Vision Zero policies to say, we are not going to design our system in a way that we have a vision to design a system that produces no traffic fatalities within our community. We are no longer going to accept those as a regular outcome or a byproduct of our transportation system. The U.S. Department of Transportation's National Road Safety Strategy just released this year also supports this general concept. But it is going to take fundamental change to how we've done our roadway designs and how we've actually laid out our communities.
Thanks for that call. Kathy joins us now in Green Bay. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I think you should allow bikes on the sidewalks. If bikes go on bike paths, I think they should face traffic and not go with it. And I think cars come way too close to bikes many times, which has been very dangerous for me because, you feel as though you're being swept off the bike path. And also with the new electric cars coming, becoming more popular, the cars are very quiet, so you don't really hear them coming from behind you either.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Kathy, thinking about the bikes too, Bob, a big part of the safety equation here.
For sure. And actually, we've seen bicyclist fatality rates also increase over the last 20 years to some of their highest levels in recent memory as well. We continue to work on the design of our bike facilities. Some of the things that Kathy points out are really fundamental to how those are designed. So one of the basic concepts is try to give bicyclists more space from motor vehicles. So in a number of cities, we're trying to design protected bike lanes. So it feels like more bicycling along a separated path than along in the street lane with cars. Those protected bike lanes may be separated by concrete buffers or planter boxes, or be on the other side of parked cars where the bicyclists are along the curb, but the parked cars are a little bit further away between the moving vehicles and the bicyclists. So that can help make bicyclists feel more comfortable and hopefully attract more people to ride in a safer environment. A key aspect of that, though, that Kathy brings up indirectly is the direction that the bicyclists are going. Mm-hmm. One of the dangers of riding along a sidewalk, if you're a bicyclist, is riding in the opposite direction of the adjacent motor vehicle traffic. If you do that, it's more dangerous at the intersection crossings or driveway crossings. So it's important to ride on the right side of the roadway in the same direction as the motor vehicles. More protection can help you feel comfortable in that situation. Same with multi-use paths. It's important to ride on the right side of the path and for all users to be on the right side unless it's otherwise marked. So those are some important guidelines for bicycling. I'll just say one other thing about bicycle facilities. As cities have installed new protected bike lanes and other bicyclist infrastructure, those roadways have become generally safer for all users. So that includes pedestrians because they often have shorter crossing distances. So they'll be able to cross the bike lane, but then have narrower roadway lanes for motor vehicles to cross. And then the motor vehicles on those corridors will often be going at a slower speed because it's a more multimodal environment. In some cases, the number of motor vehicle travel lanes is reallocated and reduced so that you can provide those bike lanes, which in turn provides those safety benefits for both pedestrians, bicyclists, and the motor vehicle users.
Thanks for that call, Kathy. In just our last half a minute or so, Bob, do you see key planners taking these issues more seriously in recent years?
I think that people are taking it more seriously, but one of the big challenges is we have a system with lots of momentum behind it. It will take rethinking many, many arterial roadways in our urban and suburban communities, thinking about where can we make them be designed for a little bit slower speeds so that we enhance pedestrian and bicyclist safety, and ultimately think about how can we design a community where walking, biking, mass transit are more attractive so that we don't have to have as many motor vehicles out on the roadway, which introduce risk to pedestrians and bicyclists.
Bob, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks again for having me.
That's Robert Schneider, professor and chair of UW-Milwaukee's Department of Urban Planning, with us today to talk about ways to make streets safer after a rise in pedestrian deaths during the pandemic. Coming up after the news, we'll dig into the future of electric vehicles and the impacts of new tax credits in the Inflation Reduction Act just passed by Congress. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.